I stumbled out of bed. I got ready for the struggle. Smoked a cigarette and I tightened up my gut. I said, this can't be me. Must be my double. And I can't forget. I can't forget. I can't forget, but I don't remember what. I'm burning up the road. Got this old address of somebody that I knew. It was high, it was fine, it was free. Ah, you should have seen her. And I can't forget. I can't forget. I can't forget, but I don't remember. I'll be there today with a big bouquet of cactus. I got this ring that runs on memory. And I promise, cross my heart, they'll never catch up. Oh, but if they do, just tell them it was me. I love you all my life. That's how I wanna end it. Summer's almost gone and the winter's tuning up. The summer's gone, but a lot goes on forever. And I can't forget. I can't forget. I can't forget, but I don't remember what. Defenses are here in the clothes of some woman I would like to forgive, in the rings of her silk, in the hinge of her thighs, where I had to go begging in beauty's disguise. Good night, good night. My night after night, my night after night, after night, after night. And I thank you. I thank you for doing your duty. You keepers of truth, you guardians of beauty. Your vision was right, my vision was wrong. I'm sorry for smudging the air with my song. La 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 la. Save me a place in the $12 grave with those who took money for the pleasures they gave, with those always ready, with those who undressed so you could lie down with your head on somebody's breast. And the ladies go moist, and the judge has no choice. A singer must die for the lie in his voice. La la la, la la la, la la la.
Take Manhattan, then we take Berlin.
don't like your fashion business, mister. And I don't like these drugs that keep you thin. And I don't like what happened to my sister. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. Tell them, lady. Plywood violin. Yeah, I practiced every night. Now I am ready. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. To live for music. Remember me, I brought your groceries in. Oh, well, it's Father's Day, everybody's wounded. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin. Thank you, friends. Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. Now you're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yeah. Jane. If you ever come by here, be it for Jane or for me, I want you to know your enemy is sleeping. I want you to know his woman is free. Here's some thanks for the trouble. So I never really tried. Ah, yes, Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her that night, that you planned to go clear. Sincerely, El Cone.
Thank you. Mr. Bob Metzger on the electric guitar. Mr. Tom McMoran on the keyboard. Mr. Bobby Fergal on the violin. Mr. Steve Zirkel on the electric bass. Now listen to the drummer. Mr. Steve Metter on the drums. Good night, my darling. Hope you're satisfied. Your bed is kind of narrow. Yeah, but my arms are open wide. And here's a man, and he's still working for your smile.
With the thou.
It has been a great privilege for all of us to be able to sing before the heroic sons and daughters of Iceland. We will never forget this evening. Thank you. Thank you so much.
First of all, on your concert Friday night, are you going to concentrate on your new album, or is it a mixture of all your career?
There are quite a few songs that we've rehearsed from the new album. And of course, there's some of the old songs like Bird on the Wire, Who by Fire, Suzanne, So Long Marianne, Story of Isaac. Songs like that that people ask for, so I couldn't rehearse every song because it's over 100 now. But there's a number of songs from the all through the catalog, as they say.
How many songs are you going to sing? 75?
It really depends on the audience. We sing a reasonable amount of songs, and if people want to hear more, we generally sing more. We go from 2 to 3 hours, sometimes longer, in a concert, depending on what the people like and what the curfew of the hall is. And there's some factors that determine how long it can go.
You mentioned the Blue Lagoon. What do you think of that?
Well, I love hot springs, and I'm an addict of hot springs. I would rate this as the best spring I was ever in.
Are you a swimmer yourself?
Yes, but I don't swim. I don't swim in hot springs. I just sit.
About your music, people are always talking about now these days that your music has changed a lot. But isn't it your music is the same, but you're only using new techniques?
Well, it's true that people think that my music has changed a lot, but that's because the only other song they've heard is Suzanne. It's quite all right. I don't have any particular attitude towards people who haven't followed my work diligently from record to record and book to book. It's perfectly all right. But usually observation comes from people who don't know what I've done between my earliest record and the most recent one. And every record is different, one from the other. And I've always used whatever technology is available. Just the whole recording procedure is very different now from a technical point of view than it was 25 years ago when I began. So whatever is around and whatever is appropriate, I've used synthesizers I've used in the last two albums.
About your lyrics, in your earlier works, they seem to be more erotic and passionate than today. Why is that?
I guess I'm over the hill these days.
What is your perspective as a poet?
My
perspective.
Well, I never had a strategy or a program, I don't even think that I've ever claimed the title poet. I think that's a verdict that is given by others after the work is finished. Mine isn't finished yet, and I never made the claim for poet.
Have you always written with music in mind, or the words alone?
I've always, even when I was writing prose, or what they call poems, I've always had some invisible guitar playing in the back of my mind, it's true.
You said you were over the hill, judging by the beginning of the lyrics and the title song. Do you feel old age coming upon you?
I don't feel it coming upon me, but there's every evidence that something is changing.
Who is taking Manhattan and Berlin?
This is an
revolutionary.
Well, it's revolutionary in a certain sense, but it's not political. I don't think that I'm not addressing myself to the headlines of the day, but I think there are larger movements that affect mankind. And I think that one of the things we're seeing is a kind of, I can't speak for this country because I don't know the politics of this country, but in many of the countries that I've visited and that I follow, there seems to be today a great gap between public expression and private feeling. I think this is cyclical, but we're in one of those moments when the way politicians speak, and not only politicians, but the way public figures speak, writers, filmmakers, the whole tone of public expression is very, very far from the inner life that people are leading. I think we go through periods like that, and we're in one of them now. And the consequence of this predicament, of this situation, is boredom. People feel a great sense of boredom. They don't feel their leaders are speaking to them. They don't feel the policies express their own policies. They don't feel the books speak to them or the music. I think we're in one of those periods now. It's nothing to be alarmed about. They're merely of a cyclical nature.
And what's there to do about it?
Well, you have to take responsibility for your own life. I don't have to tell this to Icelanders. I mean, that's the point, is that we have been bred in the past generation or two to rely on the public version of our own lives. The public world has become so strong, the media has become so powerful, that the idea of an inner life, of a private life, is eroding. And when that erodes, people become bored because nobody is addressing their deepest instincts and their deepest appetites. So in moments like that, other kinds of writers emerge, and they present programs for the redemption of the inner self or the resurrection of the inner self. And I think we're on the edge of one of those periods now when a new kind of voice will arise that will eventually, you know, atrophy itself, eventually get boring itself. But in terms of what public expression is now, the challenge of that boredom is a new kind of expression, and an aggressive kind of expression, and a witty kind of expression to combat the deadness of the word. The word seems to be dead all around us, so it provokes a kind of demented spirit like myself to say, well, forget it, we'll take it over ourselves.
Is it maybe because people are asleep?
Well, I think it's legitimate for people to go to sleep from time to time when they get tired. You know, I think people have gone through a lot. You know, there's been concentration camps, Christ has been crucified in Calvary, and everything in between. You know, you can't blame people for wanting to get a couple of, you know, take a snooze now and then. But it's legitimate to rest, but I'm speaking more of a kind of deadness in the word that takes place after a while. It's organic, you know, the word is born and the word sustains itself and then the word gets tired and dies. And we're in one of those periods when public expression is somewhat exhausted. You can hear it in the slogans of the politicians, you can hear it in the pop music, you can feel it in the literature and the movies, you know. We're just in one of those periods that are going to give birth to something a little more vital, that's all. But we shouldn't take an antagonistic view of the thing, you know. This is just the way it goes.
So we are maybe living in the world of praises.
World of?
Praises.
Dead words, a lot of dead words around.
On a recent interview on the Norwegian television, you were asked if you were a pacifist, and you said no. Is that word, pacifism, is it a dead word or a boring word?
Well, it's a boring word because these are words that are, those kind of conversations only take place in situations where the whole problem is not on the line. It's not a matter of life and death, you know. And in those situations where it is life and death, nobody's going to stop to philosophize on whether they're pacifists or not. I'm not a pacifist because I come from a small people that has been persecuted throughout history, and I understand that self-defense is a necessity. Now, you know, luxurious industrial democracies can debate the notion of pacifism or non-pacifism. It's completely a luxury based on military might and money. When a nation is small and its existence is precarious and it's very continuity is threatened by its neighbors, the notion of pacifism is ludicrous.
So is pacifism just for nations which have already got peace?
Yeah, pacifism is a luxury of wealth and power.
But again, about the song First Attack Manhattan, did you intend it for Jennifer Warnes? It's a very good song to give away.
Well, I've given a lot more than songs to Jennifer Warnes. I'd give her anything. In my opinion, she's one of the finest singers around today. She has the gift from the gods. You know, anything, the sound of her voice is agreeable to the heart. Anything she sings is beautiful, and I'm very happy that she chose my songs to sing. And I had already recorded the First We Make Take Manhattan, and she heard it, and we modified the song for her, as opposed to Ain't No Cure for Love, which is a version I made for her.
So did you work on that whole album, Famous Blue Raincoat, with Jennifer Warnes? You were in the process the whole time?
I was there most of the time, but I can't take any responsibility for its excellence. I was there a kind of moral support, and you know, I was at many of the recording sessions, and occasionally Jennifer would ask me, you know, what take of a song I preferred, or if I had an idea about it. But her musical instincts are very highly developed, and she has impeccable musical taste.
What about other musicians who might not have that musical instinct taking your songs? I mean, how would you view that?
Well, I tell you, as soon as I hear one of my songs done by another artist, my whole critical faculties evaporate. And I'm happy that anybody's doing anything of mine.
Is it true, First We Take Manhattan is in its full length, 75 verses?
I have at least four notebooks filled with verses. But I don't mean that the song is organically 75 verses long. I mean that this is no guarantee of its excellence, but it takes me a tremendous amount of time to perfect a song. And it takes often 50 verses. I need 50 verses to distill down to five.
Mm-hmm. About your new album, I'm Your Man, it is obvious that it's more commercial than the recent ones, the works in the 70s. Why is that?
I don't know exactly why it is, but I'm glad that it happened, because if I had continued on the path that I was on, from a commercial point of view, I would be extinct today. I had been dropped from my record company. I had been dropped from my publishing house. My European promoter had dropped me. I couldn't do a tour. So and still I can say with all honesty, this was not a strategy to reinstate me with the modest audience that I've gathered throughout the world. These are the only way these songs can survive. I've never been good enough or confident enough in my work to be able to say this is going to be a successful record in the marketplace. For me to finish the songs takes a tremendous effort, and this record broke down many times. The recording broke down, the writing broke down, I broke down. So under those kinds of conditions, it's impossible to plan a strategy beyond that of survival. I want the songs to exist, and these are the only form in which they can exist. If, by good fortune, the forms I've chosen coincide with the appetite of the marketplace, then I consider myself fortunate. But I may say, as I say, without any sense of virtue or pride, I have never designed my songs for the marketplace, and this record also was not designed for the marketplace. There is a happy coincidence that the marketplace has accepted it, so I'm happy about that.
So your next LP is not going to sound like I'm Your Man.
It might be a lot worse.
This song, Manhattan Again, the beat in it is clear disco beat. Was it meant to invade the discos and get the message of boredom into the discos?
The reasons we choose anything are always complex and difficult to untangle. You know, if you stop anybody in the midst of any activity and you say, you know, why are you doing it like this?
he'll be hard pressed to give you an answer, but just to throw some light on it, the lyric is very, very strong, and if it was accompanied by a kind of Wagnerian heaviness, it would justifiably be laughed out of the world. So to present that kind of lyric, which with a very sinister, menacing, and somewhat. I don't think anybody's prepared for the breakup of a union and the separation from children. That was around the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s.
Do you believe that the luxury bored people will find a way out of the boredom?
The truly bored?
Yeah, the truly bored.
The truly bored. I've got a book that is a lot about boredom. It's called Death of a Ladies Man. It's not the record. I also have a book called Death of a Ladies Man. It treats the subject of boredom from many points of view. Yeah, boredom is a kind of yogic path. You know, if you really penetrate your boredom, you can come to the other end of it. But I don't think it's... boredom is involved with a sense of alienation, a sense of separation from the world around you, a feeling that you don't have a place in the world around you. You withdraw and you start suffering from unemployment. Unemployment is always the great disease in all societies, but it takes place on all levels, not just on the occupational level. Most people are unemployed. Even those that have jobs are unemployed. They're not involved in their job sufficiently to call themselves employed. So employment is a gift and an art. And unemployment is the preface to boredom. First, we find ourselves unemployed. In other words, we find ourselves separated from the activity that is going around all the time around us. We feel we don't fit in this activity. We don't deserve to fit in, or the activity is beneath us or above us. We develop an attitude toward this whole creative activity that is God's world or the spirit world that is going on all the time. All activity. We feel ourselves alienated from this activity. We withdraw. We find ourselves with nothing to do because this is the only thing that's going on. This world is the only world that we have. When we withdraw from it, we experience boredom deeply. And sometimes through an investigation of our boredom, we can find that we really are deeply engaged in this activity, whether we like it or not, that we already are embraced by the world's activity. And once you surrender to the embrace of the world's activity, you can penetrate your boredom.
In this recent interview on the Norwegian television, you were talking about writing the period when you wrote Chelsea Hotel. You said you sat in a bar during the less glorious period of your life. Why was it less glorious?
I'm not so sure. I mean, many of my periods have been less glorious than others. Mm. I don't remember the glorious periods, to tell you the truth. I just remember the less glorious periods. I think that, you know, everybody knows what it is to feel lousy. I don't need to develop like a metaphysical basis for this. You know, I mean, you just feel lousy. You know, things don't go the way you want them to go. The ancients used, had an understanding of what luck was or fortune. You know, you just feel that you're out of sync with events and times, and nothing's working out the way you want it to work out. And when that happens, you start making mistakes. You start being unable to maintain your relationships with any degree of integrity or clarity, and the world becomes dim, and the light goes out in your heart. And you begin to hate your days. And you can get very sick once you enter into these periods. But I think all of us know what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about some unique experience. I'm talking about something that everybody knows about. So, I've had my troubles like everybody else, and that's what I mean when I say, though, sitting at a bar in one of those less glorious periods.
What music do you listen to yourself?
I don't listen to so much music. When I drive, I tend to put on the radio. So there's three or four radio stations that I'll try to tune up to in every city that I drive in. One will be the country western music, if it's there. Then there'll be like a pop music station I like to listen to.
Then there'll be one of a radio station that specializes in listener conversation, you know, where people phone in and talk about. I like those. I like to hear what people have got online. Yeah, but then there's a classical radio station I generally find out. I like to listen to that at a certain point, you know. Over 60, driving over 60, I like to listen to country western or pop music. Under 60, let's say between 40 and 60, classical music. Then in city traffic, like under 30, I like to listen to talk shows.
Have you been able to listen to any Icelandic music, pop music?
The only music I've heard from Iceland, well, I heard two songs. One at the Blue Lagoon. They were playing on the loudspeaker system. They were playing a very happy song that they were broadcasting over the Blue Lagoon. It made us very happy. I don't know whether it was that or the water, but we found ourselves jumping up and down in the water. That was really good. And then Hrap, who met us at the airport, I don't know his last name. He made this movie in the shadow of the raven. Has anybody seen it?
Everyone.
It's good, huh?
That's not right.
It hasn't been shown yet.
The pictures look great. I saw them in a magazine. But he sang us a Viking song on the bus. That was very, very good. He has a good voice.
And he likes punk music, I believe.
Yeah, punk music is good.
Well, talking about writers, what are your favorite writers? What do you read the most these days?
When I'm in hotel rooms, I tend to read the Bible a lot because they have one in every hotel room. And I generally leave the book I'm reading in the airport, in the airplane. So I've been reading the Bible a lot through my whole life. And that continues to engross me deeply. Then I tend to read the things my friends have written. This is a terrible... I hope nobody bases their education on what I'm saying. I tend to read my friends, you know, people I know. I tend to read what they write. So Irving Layton is a great Canadian poet. I tend to read him. Or... for instance, there was a man who became a very distinguished Swedish writer. We began at the same table in my house in Greece. We began writing our novels at the same time, he on one side of the table and me on the other. And he became Göran Tunström. And I always try to keep up with what he's doing, although much of it isn't translated. So he's a friend of mine. He was just here, I saw in the program.
Talking about the Bible, has it ever occurred to you because of your traveling to start collecting Bibles?
No, I was brought up with a curious sense of property. And I probably respect private property too much ever to be a revolutionary or a socialist. But I've always felt that if I take that Bible out of the hotel drawer, you know, some guy is going to be there at 3 in the morning, you know, who really needs it. He opens a drawer, you know, and he finds an IOU from me or something.
But, you've been an avid Bible reader. Your book, The Book of Mercy, has been described as one of the greatest book of religious poems for the past 50 years.
If it said 5,000, I'd get impressed. 50.
It's only 50.
It's only 50? Forget it. I don't have a religious attitude. I find myself up against the wall from time to time, and my heart cries out for help. You know, I don't know what religion it cries out in or what language it cries out in. You know, I've inherited a certain tradition, so it's natural for me to use that language and to use that tradition. But I know that, you know, I know that God doesn't exist in the terms that human beings have described for God to exist in. You know, any of the notions that we have of the absolute are, you know, totally soiled by our own experience. So our own experience is a tiny experience, you know, and it is not the experience of the absolute. Our experience is embraced by the absolute, but That's about as far as it goes. So naturally, the things I would write when my heart cries out are in terms of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Also, you know, I've studied with an old Japanese gentleman for many years, so I'm also poisoned by certain Buddhist viewpoints. Although I was having a drink with my old teacher a few months ago before I began this tour, and he looked at me and he said, "Cohen," he said, "I've known you for 18 years. He said, "I never tried to give you my religion. I just pour you sake." So he was very generous never to try to give me his religion.
So the Bible is first and foremost the literature for you?
No. I think that religion is one of the art forms of mankind, perhaps its greatest art form. The formation of a religion and the accretion of all the information and the deep experience that men have in establishing a religion is not to be taken lightly. A religion is the sum of people's experience with the absolute. So it's not just literature. It's not just literature. It is literature that is inspired by very profound sources.
Is it maybe because people feel themselves alone all the time?
Well, we go into this trance of loneliness. We hypnotize ourselves into a condition of loneliness. Loneliness is just a human idea. It's just the result of our not being able to connect with the activity around us, to feel that we are different one from another, to feel that there's another, to feel that there is another. In other words, to go into the trance of subject and object, where you believe that you are the subject at the center of the world and everything else is an object, the other person, the other object. You know, you're here and everything else is over there. But there's another point of view, which is the point of view of the absolute, in which the subject and the object have an equal footing. And that is, and we are embraced, both subject and object, by this absolute. So we go into a trance, we enter into a fiction, into a hypnosis, where we believe that we are separate from everything else. That produces suffering, the sense of separation. And religion is a technique or a device or the experience of others who have found a way to dissolve this fiction of separation from the creative activity all around us.
Have you studied philosophy?
No. I can't understand philosophy. I mean, I've really tried. You know, I took courses in it, and I tried to study it. But it speaks of a... It seems to be concerned with establishing systems that don't contradict themselves. And I don't know, when you're in pain and when you need help, when you need comfort, I suppose some natures can go to philosophy, but my nature, I never read from a point of view of luxury just to acquire information. I read or I studied because I was in trouble. So philosophy never addressed my own personal trouble, but religion did.
Anyway, you, in a way, speak like a philosopher.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'm sorry about that.
You know, in the 70s, folk musicians seemed to be a sort of a family. Well, I mean, Joan Baez, Judy Collins, Bob Dylan, yourself. Do you have any contact with these people now?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. I think there's a fraternal sense among some of these old dinosaurs. I mean, you know, Dylan will usually come to one of my concerts if we're in the same town. I'll usually go to one of his. We'll generally meet afterwards for a cup of coffee. I just had dinner with Joni Mitchell before I started this tour. Judy Collins dropped into a party that CBS reluctantly gave me a few months ago. I think there is some kind of contact, but I think except for a few minutes, maybe 10 or 12 minutes in 1965, I don't think there was ever a great sense of family. As soon as money entered the arrangement, and as soon as people felt that there were fortunes to be made and fame to be achieved, I think the fraternal sense broke down significantly.
Do you miss those years?
No, I don't have a nostalgic nature. I don't miss things. I miss my dog.
Oh, yeah.
I miss my dog, but I don't miss sociological events.
But it's been, people are talking about going to your concert. You hear everywhere, well, you suffer from nostalgia. Because people are going so much.
I don't know. I myself don't. You know, I'm a very hard-hearted person on this point of view. You know, what's past is past. So I don't regret the times. I never thought much of the 60s when they were going. You know, so I don't have much to regret. I thought they were taken over by the merchants very, very fast, the 60s. I said the 60s became a media event very, very quickly. And it was clear that the moneymakers moved into the whole scene very, very fast. So I don't have any sense of regret about that, you know. Certain things happened in the 60s. Certain openings occurred. And like any generation, it influenced the generations to come. But it certainly was not the golden age, in my point of view.
Are you looking forward to the concert?
Well, I'm always somewhat anxious about a concert, especially a concert, you know, in which I'll be using equipment that is not my own.
So
sound system.
You surely not been to be here before.
No, I mean that it was impossible to transport our own sound system here. So we're using, a sound system that I'm not associated with. But even if it were our own sound system, I would be anxious about the concert. I've never taken a concert casually, never one. And because you're dealing with forces that you can't command, you know, and as good as you want to be, as giving as you want to be, as well rehearsed as you might be, if the spirit isn't on you, then the concert won't be any good.
That's one thing about those big and famous ones. When they go on a concert tour in Europe, they always forget this little place which Iceland are. Maybe we expect you to come again when you go on touring later?
Told him that I'd name my daughter Lorca. He was very pleased, and he asked me to set one of the poems to music as part of a project to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Lorca's assassination by the fascist civil guard. So I was very happy to do it, but the translation they gave me from the official translator of the Lorca estate was not rhymed, and it was not in 3-4 meter. So it was impossible to set it to music, and I had to get permission from the estate to begin a translation of my own, and I was very sorry that they granted me the permission, because then I really had to go to work, and it took me 150 hours just to do the translation, because I don't speak Spanish. I had to work from dictionaries and Spanish friend and literal translations. So it really was a very intense labor to bring that song to completion.
You have been very popular in Europe, and, you know, how many concerts have you had? 50 in Europe now?
We've done about 53 or 54 concerts.
But what about the States? What about your popularity there?
I have two or three listeners in the States. I think they mostly live in New York, Greenwich Village. I think there's three or four left.
No, seriously, why don't you think you're as popular in the States as in Europe?
It's hard to say. You know, the market forces in the United States are much more savage than the market forces in Europe, although it's changing here also. Do you consider yourselves part of Europe?
Oh, yes, of course.
I'm sorry to hear that. I thought you considered yourself a radical entity apart from all associations. I'm sorry.
Do you feel that the Canadian press has ignored you?
No, I don't go around with a chip on my shoulder on this matter. I'm very happy that I've been able to survive as a writer and as a composer. I realize how precarious that kind of choice, the life that kind of choice brings you, you know. I've been able to survive. I've been able to bring up my family. I've been able to move freely across the face of this world. I haven't amassed great amounts of money. I haven't the huge audiences that other writers or singers have, but I'm very content with the way things have gone, and I feel myself fortunate.
Your first novel, The Favorite Game, how much is Bremann and Cohen the same person?
It's pretty close.
In the novel, Bremann and Krantz go to a socialist party meeting, but mainly to look at the girls.
That's all I've gone anywhere for.
Does that describe your attitude to politics in general?
I have a different notion of politics. I see politics on a much vaster scale than the coming election or the particular item that is being debated in the municipal council at any given moment. I think I am deeply interested in politics, but I see a wider a vaster movement in politics. So for me, politics, yes, is very much involved with how men feel about women. You know, I don't think that a system can be established from above. I think that systems express the kind of feelings we have about our personal relationships. So there's not going to be justice in a society. Women are not going to get a fair deal. If men have certain views about women, you know, in their beds, in their living rooms, in their kitchens, and vice versa, women about men. So that if I'm part of a group of investigators that is throwing some kind of light, maybe a dim light, maybe a distorted light, on these relationships between men and women, between men and men, between women and women, where I think politics begins. So in that sense, I consider myself a political writer.